quartet class. So I'm going to include some examples of my string quartet, which I didn't have before, to illustrate. We have the composers in the string quartet class. We have talked a lot about the problems of structure, and I will be talking about the solutions I have found in my own music for these problems. I realize also that many of you will be completely unfamiliar with my music and who I am, so I will also talk a little bit about my background and my the influences that have been important for me, and basically what makes my music be different from anybody else. One of the things that is, of course, important is the fact that I come from Mexico and that I have lived in Europe for half of my life. So my music reflects a very strong influence of the European tradition. It was in Europe where I can say where I really became a composer. But also there is a strong influence from my cultural background of my country. While living in London, of course, I have been exposed to music from many parts of the world, so I will talk also about non-Western music and how has this affected me. Living in London, one of the of course, one of the very important cultural influences for everyone living there is India. The Indian population is quite big, and we are lucky, those we live there, to have been able to hear Indian music. And for me, at least, was a wonderful discovery. And it was, at the time when I first arrived, a very rich source of inspiration. I became very interested. And when I was a student, when I was doing my master's degree, I concentrated a lot on this music, and I have found since. Okay. Hello? You can hear me? Okay. So I have found that many aspects of Indian music, particularly that of rhythm, I have found that many of these principles can be applied to Western music, and I will show how this has made an imprint in my thinking. When I say Indian music, I'm particularly referring to the music of Northern India, and mostly the music from Kathak dance, and obviously the talas of the tabla. I will speak now of one particular formula which is the source of a very important way of thinking in me. This cadential formula is called Tihai, and which means three-part, and it consists of a three-times repetition of a phrase in order to create a cadential, an end. As you know, in Indian music, the instruments have more limitations regarding chromaticism. If you have a flute player, for example, depending on the size of the flute, it can only play on that scale. It doesn't have the rich chromatic possibilities of the Western flute, for example. So if we tune the sitar to one raga, you stay in that raga from beginning to end. Also, the music of India has this drone, so where you start is where you end, always. So the way of creating a cadence for Indian music is always through rhythm and melody. In this, I have found that with this principle, this rhythmic principle of repeating a phrase, I will show you an example. So it's a rhythm that can go, repeats three times and can go against the beat. And it's only at the end of the last and third repetition where it comes to the first beat. And then is when we have the sense of, is when it's when it's finished. When you are in Indian music concerts and you have very knowledgeable Indian people in the audience, you almost can hear the audience with a sigh of relief the moment of this cadential formula arrives. This is enriched also by the virtuoso abilities of the tabla player. I'm going to play a very, very clear example, very basic example of work I did for a rather amateur group in Mexico. It was it's a group that was mostly a free jazz group called La Banda Elástica, which translates literally as Elastic Band. And they have amongst their players a tabla player. So I had my limitations in the challenge I could set to these musicians, because they didn't have the same range of abilities, playing abilities, as someone like the Arditi Quartet, of course. But for me, the limitations sometimes are a good thing. So in this piece, we'll show you now this example. So you can see that where it says T high over there, this little formula repeats three times. And when the last repetition comes, it will fall on the first beat of the next cycle. Another thing I forgot to say is that Indian music is built upon rhythmic cycles. So it can be 16-beat cycle, it can be 7-beat cycle, 10-beat cycle. In this piece, it's only 16-beat cycle, what we're going to hear. The number four, it's also an example of another cadential formula, the chakadar, that, as you say. So is the whole formula is repeated three times in itself. So it has small cadential formulas within and is in itself a cadential formula. It's normally used to end a whole piece, which is how I used it in this piece. So this example, it's the ending of a work which is called Tres Piezas in Memoriam Laurie Josephs, which was a British sculptor and a good friend of mine, a great lover of music, and this is why it's the piece. I think I will leave this example so you can see. Can we have the first audio, please?
Thank you. titta, fredda titta, grant da titta.
So this is a very clear example where you can see and hear all the those repetitions and relationships. Of course, if you have, as you heard in this example, if you have Western instruments, you have more chromatic possibilities. And for me, this was a source of how to expand with the chromatic possibilities. Is there a problem? Oh, no, sorry. With the chromatic options that we have with Western instruments, we can enrich this, expand this into the harmonic structure of big sections within a piece of music. And not only that, with the virtuoso abilities of Western instrumentalists, for example, like the Arditi Quartet that we have been working, you can really make this rhythmic, intricate elaborations richer. I have expanded this idea a lot farther from here, and I have been playing sometimes with different layers. I have also applied the principle of counterpoint in the sense, not just in the literal sense of 16th century counterpoint, but more in a wider manner by giving, for example, different instruments phrases of different lengths. So while in Indian music we have phrases that are always 16 beats. Yeah. Mind you, when in the example we saw above, the tihai is shorter, and this is what makes it sometimes interesting. The subdivisions Indian musicians can do while improvising, they're extraordinary. I mean, the mathematicians playing, you know, it's really, really intricate. So we can play with that, and I have been exploring this. So by giving different instruments, different phrases of different lengths, you can start building upon different structures that can be longer. And sometimes, at some point, they coincide. For me, these have been important moments within the structure of a piece of music. The moment, well, all these different phrases will coincide, can mark the beginning of a new section within a piece. So I will play a small example now of my string quartet. I will show you first how this is. Okay.
So here's like a small diagram of this section, which will happen at some point in the string quartet. We're going to hear precisely that moment. And it's when all the phrases finish and coincide. It's pointed out by I think it's a diminished chord, if I remember correctly there, which is taken out of the harmonic material I used in this piece, and it opens up a new section. Apart from the different lengths of the each phrase has a different character. Probably the cello and the viola have similar gestures or more similar with each other, but certainly not the violin and the second violin, or have completely different material. So if we can have the second example, please. A further elaboration of this, I'm going to play further on in the string quartet, where I combine this principle of different beats, structures, phrases of different lengths with Fibonacci principles. The way the phrases change follow a different Fibonacci patterns, and within itself, each one of them has different subdivisions. I'll show you in the example.
Hilda, could you only explain why you use septulets with the lead at the beginning? Why you use like that?
No.
This rhythm is really strange. A septulet at the beginning. Why you use...
Oh, no. This is just a diagram. This is a diagram. But if you what you heard, it wasn't just one note. It was a septuplet completely. Yes, that's not what the music does. This is a diagram of the beginning of each layer. What is happening in the music, I think you heard the seven septuplets. Yes, sorry. These are diagrams. What I'm putting in the examples are diagrams, in fact. I'm sorry. You want to repeat your question, please?
So, excuse me very much to interrupt you, but I was just confused by the sketches here and what we were listening, because the first beat in the septuplet, or you have the eighth notes. There was no reason to write an eighth note in a septuplet.
So why you have a
triplet or a quintuplet, or okay. This was means nothing. So
no.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry. The music, what you heard was not a septuplet without the rest. What you heard was a complete septuplet. This is just the diagram. This is why I play the music. Yes? The second violin plays a septuplet in that figuration. And then all the figurations, I mean, there are phrases of different... I'm just pointing out the moments where they start. Yes? Where the different phrases start, for you to see how the music is built. I'm not writing all the music here. I'm just writing the diagram of how the structure was worked out. Okay? Clear? Okay. Well, the example I'm going to put on is also a diagram. The music, this is not the music. As in the end result, this is done after the music. It's so it's just trying to make clear how I worked it out. Okay, so what you hear rhythmically is the note, the long note underneath. The subdivisions above represent the kind of subdivisions I thought in order to build this. So we have, for example, 21 quintuplets. Yes, 21 quintuplets long that note. The second layer, the first layer, we have 32 semiquavers long. The next layer, we had before 29 septuplets, then 18 septuplets. So I'm using the two combinations, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, etc. And 1, 3, 4, 7, 11, 18, etc. Yeah? But with different subdivisions. So this rhythmically creates within itself a very rich texture, and at the same time, it enables me to create a long phrase, a long stretch. I start making the length of the notes shorter every time. So after 20 quintuplets long, the next length will be 13 quintuplets long. And the next time it will be 8 quintuplets long. 5, 3, 2, 1. And when we all, there's a moment when they all coincide, when they all get to 1 in this phrase, in this section. And at that moment, it's a very strong moment. We have only 3 instruments playing there. At that moment, the viola comes in with a solo. And this process is reversed at the end of that section, but we are only going to hear this for the moment. Can we have the next example, please? So this process, which is very horizontal in these two examples we've just heard, can be applied also in a more vertical way and treat the instruments and the ensemble in a different way. It is the case in the third section of the string quartet, which we're going to hear, and which I... just can show you the score of this. That you have no more light. But tomorrow I will bring the scores and we'll be able to hear all the pieces I will talk about, or most of them. So in the third section of the piece, I combine within the structure the principles of the Fibonacci series and this principle of threefold repetition, which I fell in love with in Indian music. So we have a section which is 13. So how it's worked out is the material is beginning to expand from 5 to 8 to 13 to 21. And then there's a big, a longer section of 21 beats long, which of course you can divide in 3 very easily
And there, it is there where I have this threefold repetition. You're going to hear it very clearly because it's signaled by the fact that it's a pizzicato section, so it's signaled by the introduction first of an F sharp in the viola, which is played arco. So can we hear this next example, please? So that F sharp at the top also signals an important moment in the Fibonacci series at 34, which is the highest moment in this movement and is the moment at which the whole structure collapses to take us to the last section. For the last, the final part of the quartet, I have chosen each movement of this, or each section, because they're played without interruption, makes a reference to one member of the quartet. It's built like a play, and each member of the quartet has a different personality. So the last one, it's like a homage or like a little reference to Rohan, and it also makes enables me to work further into my concept of Indian rhythms. This time, very different to how I did it in the other piece, this time is transformed. There is a transformation, but I have borrowed from Indian dance one rhythm which is used to show the virtuosity of the dancers in the feet. So the original rhythm, Indian rhythm, is like that. Tat 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 tikidigatigatitei. Tat 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 tikidigatitei. Tat 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 tikidigatitei. Tat 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 tikidigatitei. Tat 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 tikidigatitei. Tat 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 tikidigatitei. Tat tat tikidigatitei. Tat tat tikidigatitei. Tat tikidigatitei. Tat tikidigatitei. Tat tikidigatitei. Tat tikidigatitei. Tat tikidigatitei. And then they go off to the virtuosity. So that's the... Not me. This is my transformation, and of course this is enriched by the harmonies and the possibilities of the instruments, of course. But the source is that where it comes from, and it is transformed completely at the end of the string quartet. Can we have the next example, please? Thank you. So I hope we have a chance to hear it all tomorrow. I want just to move on, to continue talking about different ways to deal with some of the aspects we've been talking about the last week. For me, it's very important, the dramatic development. One thing I like very much of this idea is this contraposition of ideas. That's, for me, the essence of this rhythm is how one interrupts the other. Yes, the both different gestures. Tat, 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 tigritay, tat, tat, tat. So this idea is something that also has been an inspiration for many other ways of thinking and expanding this. An example of this is the end of another piece I'm going to play for you today, in which I combine four different ideas, very short ideas, which interrupt each other, and how gradually one grows more out of the other, while the beginning, the first cell begins to disappear into the distance, and how the music develops. I will show you it's the diagram, but not the music. Benfrit?
I could understand very well.
So these are the four cells that appear in this example I'm going to play. This is part of a bigger piece, which is an homage to a Spanish painter, Remedios Varo, who escaped Spain during the Civil War in 1936 and ended up in Mexico. And she arrived in Mexico at the time of the muralist, the large canvases which were being done at the time. And she remained working in very small canvases. And all her paintings, I think they can belong to more of a surrealist expression rather than more than the socialist context that prevails in the muralist works of the Mexican painters of that period. So this homage to Remedios Varo is made out of five pieces. Each one of them makes a reference to one of her paintings. Yes. Yes, I will. Let's. Each of these short pieces makes a reference to one of her paintings, and the last piece, it makes a reference to this painting. Can we have it? Which is called. One moment, please. This is called Still Life Surviving, or Naturaleza Muerta Resucitando. And it's actually the last painting that she finished before she died in 1963. Okay.
Thank you.
Another way of that I have found to be able to create a kind of dramatic development within a piece of music is by treating the instruments, as I did in the string quartet, like characters, independent characters. And each one of them brings some new proposal when it comes to the foreground and then disappears into the background, as well as treating the ensemble as one instrument. So a combination of both is a clear example of what you will hear on Wednesday in the string quintet, in the piano quintet, sorry, in which the beginning of the work is treated as one instrument, and how in the transition, the first transition, which is what we'll hear now, the whole ensemble, including the piano, goes to the background to bring room. One second. give room to allow the cello to come through, and then disappears again. And this is the way the whole quintet is built, in a general way, of course. I'm not going to go into minute detail in this space. Okay. So we will have an opportunity to hear this piece live, which I think is more interesting. So I won't go into detail right now. I would like to talk a little bit about my background in regarding my country, because this is important also in my work. The history of Mexico is one of relentless cultural impositions on other cultures. The conquest of Mexico was the beginning of a history that unfortunately has not ceased to look to the first world for cultural stereotypes and ways of living, to try and shape an identity and its development. However, like the Mexican Nobel Prize winner said, Octavio Paz said once, that there is no modernism without tradition. And it is this link towards our past culture that creates our present and gives an impulse to the future. It is also relevant that for most indigenous languages, indigenous cultures in Mexico, future does not exist, and the present is unmistakably attached to their ancestry. For several centuries, there has been a widening gap between the modern Mexico, or the Western Mexico, and the indigenous communities. It took an uprising in 1994 in the poorest communities of southern Mexico for the rest of the country and the rest of the world to become aware of the rich differences intrinsic in their cultural heritage, and unfortunately as well as the extreme poverty in which these people are barely surviving. Very few things have changed, but I hope that one day we will be able to eradicate this discrimination and that these people will have, that have preserved many aspects of our identity, will have equal opportunities for a better life. In an attempt to achieve a homogeneous society, many policies have been practiced in Mexico through the centuries, very strongly, unfortunately, also in the 20th century, to eradicate different indigenous languages and impose Spanish as a unique one. This practice has done a lot of damage to the development of the languages as such, which is only spoken with fluency by the older generation. However, we have witnessed in the last decade some effort to rescue this heritage. And the literature, that is, the modern literature, because we have poets of our age still working or beginning to be published and to be studied at universities. So this has been very important for me, and in the past few years I have been attempted to integrate the richness of this languages as sound and as literature into my own music. My first attempt was some 6 or 7 years ago, where I did my first setting of the Mayan language. This was old Mayan language into music. And I chose some spells. These were ancient spells that were used in the ancient Mayan times in the aristocracy, by the shamans. The shamans had the role of something between a doctor, a priest, and a shrink. You know, they were the three in one, and they used this combined with the use of herbs to cure people. This practice is still done in many, many parts of the South Mexico and Guatemala and Belize also. Of course, this time the language is modern Maya. So the language used in this piece is the language that was used from the aristocracy at the time of the arrival of the Spaniards. I'm going to play, one moment, can I just finish? I'm going to play the second part of this piece, which refers to a text that is used to bewitch spiders. It is also an invocation to Ixchel, which was the Mayan goddess of fertility, but it's also portrayed as a weaver because it's also the one that has the threads of fate to guide you. As in many of or all the spells in this compilation, which is like this thick, the language is very symbolic, so it's very often very logical. But this is something that was fascinating for me. And often they use very rude words. In this case, my interpretation of these rude words is that it's perhaps used to dispel the damage caused by the spiders. They're very poisonous in this part of the world, so maybe this is the reason. And towards the end of this piece, there is a very subtle game of words with the word am, which is in Maya means spider. And which turns into Amen, which is the cultural influence of the time. Okay. I have. This was for me for my first incursion into using this language. I found great possibilities, particularly also to do with the qualities of the sound, which has sounds that you don't find in Western languages. I think you found sounds like this, like you said, yeah. You find them in South Africa, I think, amongst the Osas, no. And I became very interested in these possibilities as sound and also as literature. So this was something I was able to explore in a much more deeper way in my opera that I wrote not so long ago, El Palacio Imaginado, which was translated as Phantom Palace, but I prefer that Imaginary Palace as translation. This opera, for me, is also the representation of many political and historical problems of my country. On the one hand, we have this incredibly rich culture surviving almost underneath another reality which has been artificially imported from Western countries and imposed over there. So the opera is mostly about that, and therefore the title, El Palacio Imaginado, the Imaginary Palace. It is based on an original story by Isabel Allende, the Chilean writer, which has the same title. But of course it's changed a little bit to serve the purposes I was looking for in this piece. So the story takes place in San Jerónimo, a village somewhere in Latin America, where the natives have been living for several thousand years. These Indians were an ancient tribe, so poor that no one had bothered to extract taxes from them, and so meek that they had never been recruited for war. Gradually, the Indians, who did not die in slavery, or as a result of tortures, or as victims of unknown illnesses, scattered deep into the jungle. Always in hiding, they survived for centuries, speaking in whispers and mobilizing by night. They came to be so skillful in the art of dissimulation that history did not record them. No one has seen them, but the peasants who live in the region where our story takes place say they have heard them in the forest. So this is the opening scenario for the piece. The way I worked on this idea was by integrating electronic means made out of sounds that I have collected in Mexico and fragments of poems of which you all have a copy that you were given. The beginning, and poems of contemporary poetry, poets that are in the late 30s and early 40s and very actively creating their work. For the opening to set this introduction I just read, I chose two contemporary poems and I did a setting of another fragment of this ancient compilation of spells. So I will just read for the interpreters, I will read the poems before we hear the music, so those that don't speak English can understand the meaning of the poems you will hear just now. The first one is by a Mazateco poet. Mazateco is spoken in the region of the Pacific coast, towards the south of Mexico, not so much in the coast, but more in the mountains, but in that state of Oaxaca. His name is Juan Gregorio Regino. And the poem, in its sound, recreates very much the sound which is, and the way the prayers are said still now, where they have religious ceremonies when they eat the hallucinatory mushrooms in this region. And the poem reads like this. 400 measures of distance, 400 leagues towards infinity. Light, darkness, images, the sage's voice reaches that far. Singer, healer of pain, amongst divine images, amongst earthly images. His soft voice is heard, his divine chant, his compassionate plea. He crosses the path of life as far as the sacred place where perfection dwells. There he talks, there he argues, there he pleads with the gods that rule the world's fate. A breeze lulls him off to sleep. A dormant lightning stalks him. His compassionate voice resounds in the center of the universe. Following this poem, we will hear a poem by Mayan poet Briseida Cuevas, which reads like this. Someone has worn the sandals of evil and left footprints in church. What good is there in a crowd if loneliness whistles in every person? Hypocrisy blesses itself, face and chest entangled by crossing itself. Remorse prays chewing its lips, the lie prostrate itself, softly beating its chest. Vanity has so many candles in its hand, it's like a huge bunch of flowers in its arms. Who do they love? Whom do they pray to? Whom do they condemn themselves to vehemently? Whom do they implore if even God himself remain unrecognized, treated like a dog who was cast out as soon as they spotted him out of the church? I have to just explain that this poem is part of a series of poems she wrote using the street dogs as a metaphor for how they are treated as people. And lastly, the setting is a reference to the past. Also in Maya, but ancient Maya, it reads like this. Receive what's been created. Thus creation descends onto earth, onto the sack of flints. Beware of being so confident. 4 times I undo your lies. I refer to you, Bakabe, who are my creation. For you, the best offspring will have to be sized for the subtle hunger. And thus it shall be concluded that we are still alive. 4 times I undo your lies. I refer to you, Bacchaves. And then we hear the repetition, we're still alive, we're still alive. It's a kushanilon, it repeats itself. Can we have the next example with the image, please? Two images.
Kishufa tundiya hanga sundi ndanga kujonda waisi kya changi, kya huti, kya tawushi a gihin nena shinji wa kishumanga sundi kuchunga iti ya chungki feta kunda likinda yangi ta
yang mas tu kuk cheta kum sheba hishana wil kasani kapek cheta na hichki balu bela nu mchukan mak watu shushuk akaf chana ijin bimbun tulo ka i ole kichun tzika ibichi choku ba iti kutse ni nidem zichi ibichi kushi ni tu payanchi nidem payanchi kutu chachi ibichi tuse kuchen shol kalanka kuchen lolo shi kutse shma ba ali kutu mchukan umedu ma Masti ku yamao, masti ku payal chio, masti ku yokolo, wamish mahtu ka olta yunku, betan tu hocho vite toho chinta, cheng manak ta'li tu folla. Kutna?
Okay, so this is followed by the inauguration of a summer palace, in a place where the whole year around is summer. So this is the first contradiction of a reality, unfortunately. So for the inauguration of the palace is celebrating the 20th anniversary of a totalitarian regime ruled by a dictator of the place, called in the opera The Benefactor. The speech is a display of the brutality and impunity with which different cultural and social imposition have been suffered throughout Latin America. Musically, the way I have worked with this, in the whole opera, the electronic means is always contains material for the indigenous world, and all those moments where they are obliterated, there is no electronic means. So the speech is, on the one hand, is a display of the benefactor's brutality in a very archetypal way. It's quite horrible what the dictator is saying, but it's so essentially horrible that we chose to deal with it in a humorous way, because it's the only option I could see to solve this within life and within the opera, really. In the speech, there it's all, the speech contains a lot of the material that will be worked through in the rest of the opera, which lasts about 90 minutes, the whole opera. At the end of the speech, there is a party, and for the first time, I have used a traditional melody from Mexico. In this opera, I used two traditional melodies, something I have never done. And for this purpose, I felt it dramatically, it really places it historically in a time. It's a piece of danzón. Danzón is a way of dancing that dates back to the 1940s and is still danced by many old people. And it's quite difficult to dance, actually. So there is that. And there is a reference in the celebration. There is a reference to the drum in the way the production was, and in the concept I had for the music of the entertainers that come. In the way we dealt with in this production is by using shadow puppets, which also is the metaphor for the shadows of the indigenous people that they have become. So can we have the next example with the next images, please? I will tell you when to change the images.
Thank you.
So lastly, I forgot to mention about the use of the instruments in this work. I go a step further about the way I use the instrumentation in the case, as you could hear in the speech of the dictator. The trombone has a very close role with the soloists. This is just to bring, give it more dramatic weight and more sense of irony, really. I mean, for me, it adds this level of pomposity to the drama and to what the character is about. I mentioned before about the intrinsic possibilities of sound in the indigenous languages, how I found this a very rich source. And it is particularly the case in this last example I'm going to play for you, which corresponds to the end of Act Two, in which Marcia Lieberman, who is the wife of Ambassador Lieberman, who has been sent to this godforsaken country, much to his chagrin, and the benefactor has kidnapped and raped and made her and took her with him, and then sent the husband away. So Marcia has been a subject of much abuse in several scenes up until this moment, the end of Act Two, in which Marcia, after having endured the benefactor's brutality, reaches a climatic moment in the opera in which she slides away from the embrace of the benefactor and becomes a shadow herself. With this stroke, the piece connects the fate of the oppressed Indo population with that of women in these kinds of society, in a calculating, power-obsessed, chauvinistic society. The musical backdrop for this scene is another setting of an excerpt of El Ritual de los Bacabe, which we have in, it's the eighth poem, third page. This poem is, this spell was used to cure evil, lust, whatever that might have been, as well as some fragments of Nahuatl and Popolocan languages, these two are languages still spoken in Mexico. And I enhance the sound of Mayan language both in the setting and with electronic means. Towards the end of this scene, we're going to hear a poem in Zapoteco by Natalia Toledo. This again is a language spoken in the state of Oaxaca, also near to the Pacific coast. And I will read both of them for those of you who are on French translation. So the first one from El Ritual de los Bacabe reads like this. It was exactly the fourth ahau, the one of the painful bites, the great rapacious one, the great grasping one. It was the day, it was the night of night's madness, of day's madness, when the heavens resounded, when night resounded, when the clouds resounded. In the talking stone, he spent 4 days in lying. For 4 days, he copulated. The burning sun, the deep night, the bubbling blood, copulation's madness and madness of the night, or people too. This is their weakness. And it was me, it was myself who caught you. I subdued you, I oppressed you, and stood up. And in this moment, Marcia stands up and sings an aria where she says, you cannot hurt me anymore, you don't understand beauty, you don't understand, you don't understand silence, you don't even understand death, no matter how much you sought it. And then she gradually disappears and becomes a shadow herself. The poem by Briseida, by Natalia, reads like this. To travel in the seas of silence, to become nothing in the foam, as if the body had no sign, eyes fixed on a vessel and the lock of equilibrium finding itself like a pendulum in the extremes. To lose yourself in a picture guided by Matisse, the blind man, through the paper's shape, to make that journey as if remaining in a drawing, never to return.
Thank you.
in this piece, for me, it has been a very important piece because I feel it reflects a very important conflict of my background, my country. The title itself encompasses the essence of the piece, as Guillermo Bonfil Batalla, the famous Mexican ethnologist, says about Mexico. What has been proposed as a national culture in different moments of the history of Mexico can be understood as a permanent aspiration for destroying what we are. It has always been a cultural project that neglects the historic reality of the Mexican social structure, and it therefore does not attempt the possibility of building a future on its reality. It is a project of substitution in every case. The future is somewhere else, anywhere but here in this concrete reality. The task of building a national culture consists of an imposition of an alien model, a distant one that would eliminate the cultural diversity and would achieve a unity from suppressing the existing. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Hilda. This question concerns further colonization of culture and capitalist homogeneity. The question doesn't refer to your work in a negative manner. It's just I'm looking for your opinion. So throughout history of Occidental classical music, composers have often used formal musical elements of varying cultures, often at their own discretion. I believe this phenomenon can often be done in a disrespectful way. And I'm just wondering if you think the same, and if so, what constitutes the difference? For example, I'm very critical of world music, for example, which I see as a fragmentation and dissolving of cultural musics, actually, for the entertainment of, say, tourists, for example, as a capitalist, extension of capitalist homogeneity, false culture. So I'm just wondering about your opinion on this subject.
I think the term world music was a term invented in the first world,
yes.
In the Western world. So that is up to each one of us how we take it, really. Then there is the, and that, yes, of course, if you go to all the record shops, you know, the big record shops, you have world music in which everyone is classified. I had an experience last year when I was giving a talk about other issues, but I did talk a little bit about this work. And this seemed to upset extremely someone in the audience, because for him, Mexican music was something he could shelf somewhere. Yeah? And so yes, there is a very patronizing attitude towards musics from different parts of the world. And I don't think it's my position when I work with Indian musicians. I think I try, I'm very skeptical of fusion as such. I think it's a little bit of an easy way out. However, I believe that music is, and maybe any form of art, doesn't need a passport. A passport doesn't need borders. Music can speak to anyone that wants to listen. and speak to them. And music goes straight to the heart when it's a true music, when it's honest music. My experience with Indian music is similar to I like when Stockhausen speaks about his own experience and with Indian music, and I would like to borrow his term, that when you listen to Indian music, when you discover Indian music, you find the Indian within yourself. And I think for me it is the case with many musics. It was the case with Javanese music, with gamelan music, with my own music is Mexican music is something I don't think about because it's just inside me, you know. But the patronizing attitude, I don't think it's for artists to be concerned or distracted with. I think that is something else. I don't know if I answered your question.
Are you saying that if you're an artist and you take from another culture, it's not patronizing or can't be patronizing?
I couldn't be myself. Yes, I couldn't be. I couldn't be. Because if I'm drawn to like I have been drawn to Indian music, I have great respect for it. And this is, I mean, I don't try to sound Indian, even in the first example I played for you. That's not my intention. You know, it's just a reverence, and it's something I have learned, and it has given me an enormous amount. It has given me an incredible amount of food for thought for many years. Yeah?
Thank you.
Any question?
Okay, I just wanted to continue from the last point, but more specifically with reference to your work. Wolf's asking if it is possible for someone who borrows from another culture to be patronizing, and I would have thought, for example, when, say, Saint-Saëns wrote his Africa fantasy and attempted to represent a whole continent in the most crude stereotypes imaginable, or when Verdi tried to evoke Egyptian and Ethiopian music in Aida without having visited either place or really known the first thing about them. I mean, I would have thought those could fairly be called patronizing. But what, in this context, I want to ask you is that when you engage with Mexican poetry and Mexican music, which in some sense or other, without wanting to sort of underplay what a vast country Mexico is, relates to a world that you grew up in and know well. How do you think the nature of your engagement differs from that of a Western composer or an American composer who engages with some of the same materials or same ideas?
I guess that I am emotionally very, very affected by this. For me, it's not the reason why this opera is so important to me is because I am unable to be very disturbed by this reality. It hurts me. My country hurts me. So I think that is the difference, perhaps.
Yes, well, just sort of playing devil's advocate slightly there.
Yes.
I mean, it could fairly be said that similar events in somewhere like Argentina, very faraway country, might conceivably hurt you just as much?
Absolutely. I think the problems in the whole of Latin America, maybe not.
Yeah.
Argentina is slightly different because it is...
I was just picking that example.
Yes,
because
the reason why this piece is not placed in Mexico is placed in San Jerónimo. Well, there is actually, I found out later, there is a small town in the place where they speak Mazateco called San Jerónimo, but the reason of just this piece is made of archetypes. It's made of an archetype dictator as a representative, not just of one dictator, but it represents a whole political attitude in the whole of Latin America. This is unfortunately a reality that we share certainly with Peru, certainly with Ecuador, certainly with Guatemala, Belize perhaps, I don't know. So it is very much stronger in Bolivia is another place, in places where there has been a very rich civilization in the old times, and it's still alive.
Sure, and I wouldn't dispute any of that. And we're talking, but this is talking more about things that are reflected in text and theatre and characterization. I'm looking more specifically to engagement with musical materials, generally, and how you think someone engaging with, for want of a better word, I'll call indigenous musical materials from their own country, how their attitude to it and how the way they differs from someone from another country or culture.
At the moment, there is a very interesting project in Bolivia where, I don't know if any of you were in Dona Echingen a few years ago, they came to perform, they brought the house down with all their instruments, and they are doing an extremely wonderful project where they're creating new music with their own instruments, but new music according to their own terms. And it's a very, very fresh proposal that hasn't had a lot of the Western intellectual abstractions in it. Was anybody there in Dona Echingen, I don't know, a few years ago? It's a group of South American, large group. Nobody was there.
No.
No, no. No, from Bolivia. No, this is something else. Yeah. So there are people. I am still in a process of discovering the indigenous music of my own country. So that's probably another stage for me.
Sure.
Yes, I think the whole Latin America is a big wound of imperialism and oppression, and your opera shows very, very, indeed, very, very good the situation of oppression. But what I feel as a Mexican composer, as you are presenting your music, I have a certain lack of looking to your own tradition. Juan Mario Carrillo, for example, one of the most famous composers in Mexico, who invented the 16-tone piano, who invented the third-tone piano, who invented incredible things. There's a big lack of this continuing this tradition. You're going to Indian music, which I think it's enriching, fantastic. But I think that in your own country and your own history, there are so deep history and so deep goals to find something more and deeper. So mm-hmm. Juan Mario Carrillo.
Yeah, I mean, Julian Carrillo, I think it's very important what he did. With his instruments. I personally haven't been interested in writing music for these instruments. For me, that represents a limitation. These instruments are kept in Mexico. And
not at all. It's all over the world.
They are now out.
Well,
they were there, and there were many problems there. But for me, that represents a little bit of a practical limitation, so to speak, and it's something I have not been aesthetically attracted. Regarding other composers in Mexico, I think someone like Revueltas is stronger is closer to my aesthetics and to my concern. I like mostly the fact that Revueltas never tried to be Mexican the way Chavez did, for example. The only tune that he used, he borrowed, I believe. Maybe I'm wrong, but as far as I can remember, is in La Noche de los Mayas towards the end, when the only surviving indigenous tune from the Mayas is that tune in La Noche de los Mayas. It's the only thing surviving. Everything else in Revueltas is totally original, and to my ears to my upbringing, to me, is he is deeply Mexican. And this, I think, I share with him. To be Mexican, I don't try to be Mexican, as much as I don't try to be a woman in my music. These two things are things that I'm just are.
But
yes.
You was no. It has nothing to do to be a Mexican or not to be a Mexican. I think it has nothing to do to be a woman yes. or not a woman. It has only something to be with a historical root. So I think
there is a
people
problem.
Like Nenko, please let me finish my sentence.
Yes.
People like Nenkoro, I think he is not only representing Mexican music, but he invented so much ideas of polytempic and rhythmical thoughts that also Ligeti or a whole group, a whole bunch of composers were influenced by him extremely and very strongly. Mm. So I think there are a lot of historical roots in Mexico which are not founded yet and which could be enriched in Western culture too.
I think we could talk about Nancaro's influence. I could play you some examples on the string quartet, which I didn't play today, you know, where I use different timings in certain moments. But Nancaro, you're talking about 20th century yet again. I just wanted to say something about Mexican music. What is Mexican music? Because Mexican music has also been a victim of this. As I said before, you know, from the time of the conquest, nothing has survived, mostly because the music that was used for their religious ceremonies. And this was the first thing that was suppressed in order to impose the Catholics. It was the height of the Inquisition in the empire that was Spain at that time. So that's the first thing that had to go. So this is a problem for us. There is a couple of groups in Mexico. I don't know if Juan Cristobal remembers the name of these people that are trying to recreate Aztec music. What's the name of this composer? Do you remember? Who plays with all these instruments, huehuetls and... Jorge Reyes. Yes. So there are people trying to create a Mexican music, but it's an abstraction because we don't know, because that music was not written. Then comes into Mexico the guitars, and comes into Mexico all the Jesuits that start bringing religious music. And there is a very rich music, religious music. But then again, it is a European music. It's the same case in South America. And there are records, wonderful records, about how quickly and how good the indigenous population were but to learn all these new languages and new ways of making music. And then our popular music is very, very, very new, very... I think for me, that is patronizing, to think that Mexican music is just mariachi music or bolero music, or this is a patronizing attitude. Yes, it is that, but it's not just that. And Nancaro, to get back to Nancaro, you know, I'm very glad that you say that Nancaro is Mexican. I'm very happy that you say that because after being thrown out of the United States, the North Americans are claiming him back, you know, to be American. And there is a great influence of jazz in Nancaro also. That's a point of departure for him. So then, again, that example you mentioned, you can trace it to somewhere else. So what is being Mexican? Being Mexican is what it's called... I made a trip last year, a wonderful trip, to the south of Mexico, and I went into Chiapas, and you go into a church which is absolutely stunning, and there is no pews, there is no benches, there is no priest, never a priest has been allowed in this church, and all the saints around are covered with these beautiful indigenous dresses, and this candles all over, and it's people praying. The floor is covered with pine leaves, and there is people praying in groups to different saints and towards the altar in their own languages and healing people. And with them, as part of their offering, they bring a bottle of Coca-Cola. So, I mean, what is this? You have the Catholic images dressed as indigenous. They're praying in their own languages to heal with their herbs and their all things to healing their relatives. And they bring as an offering a Coca-Cola. This is called syncretismo in Mexico. Syncretic is an imposition of cultures and how they are absorbed. And this you see it in many, many layers of the society and in the cultural expression also. You can trace many European influence even in the muralists, for example. No more questions? Thank you very much. Thank you.